Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. So let's come back to, let's zoom back out then from the detail of testing to the bigger picture of how Amazon retailers or sellers deal with the whole sourcing in China thing. The first question is, do people need to have staff on the ground in China or contacts on the ground in China? Because that's a discussion that goes around amongst the more serious sellers I know. Do you have to have a native Chinese speaker and contacts, and how do you go about finding and trusting that kind of person?
I personally think that definitely makes a huge difference, because firstly, when we talk about quality issues, I believe majority of the issues are down to communication issues. And when things go wrong, suppliers are normally like, you said this, but we understood this, and that's why this happened. So communication issues, it's just not the language itself. It's also the culture, the expectations and stuff. And obviously, when that's all being communicated in the local language, that helps, but also through a professional mechanism. For example, when we talk about putting everything in a contract and a QC checklist. So that helps. Again, having people on the ground helps in terms of negotiation itself. In low trust countries in general, like China, like India, a lot of the developing world, people like to do business with people that they have seen and somehow are connected to through their network. And the reason for that is because the trust in the systems is lower, you know, the legal systems. So people tend to do business with people they know. And that's where being on the ground, being able to visit the suppliers, present yourself, show that you have an established base, I think makes a difference in terms of pricing as well. So yeah, I think it definitely adds great value if you have people on the ground.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think particularly if you have an established business, that you may as well showcase that. I mean, there are some people that there's a couple of members in the 10K Collective, for example, who come from multi-generational family businesses. And I think that gives a sense of reassuringness. And I think sometimes people are they kind of almost hide it, like they're ashamed of it because it's old fashioned or something. And when it comes to other sellers, then maybe everyone's thinking about the latest Facebook ad hack or whatever. But when it comes to suppliers, I think that very conservative, we've been around for several generations and we own a building or a factory or something substantial, I think really helps to communicate and reassure. Would you say that is true in your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just being able to, I mean, a lot of things, you know, when we talk about credit terms and stuff with our suppliers, they like to visit our office. They like to see how long we have physically been in that office. Because still a lot of, especially people who are running small to medium-sized factories, they instead of having access to, say, due diligence tools and stuff, their due diligence is knowing you in person and making a judgment call on how much they can trust you with stuff like credit and all. So, you know, that's where these little things do make a difference. I think, I mean, to be honest, I've even seen that in the Western world, it makes a difference. But in the developing world, it's even more important because of the low trust environment.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that there is something about an in-person meeting that always builds trust. I mean, this is why I run the masterminds, and that's what the 10K Collective podcast sort of points people towards if they're based in London or Europe and can fly to meetings, because there is no substitute for meeting in person. Sure, you can have a conversation. I'm having a conversation with one of the 10K Collective members later to see if he can help me with an issue I've got with, you know, getting the podcast launched, because he's got an expertise that helps me. But the point is, we made a strong connection in a room in person, and now we're happy to talk digitally, continue the conversation. But there is, I think there is no substitute for meeting people. So now another question that always comes up, if people are in touch with people, if sellers are in touch with people in China, I should say, The other classic question, how can you tell who works directly for a factory and who is an agent? Because I've heard of people, like a friend of mine lives out in China, his girlfriend's Chinese, and actually Chris Davey has, in fact, somebody I should probably get on the podcast as well, interesting chap. He said his girlfriend at one point is working for as an agent, and she would even have a uniform for one of three different factories she worked with and would line up with the other factory staff. So she went to massive lengths to pretend to be in the factory, even though she was actually an agent. So what's your experience about that?
So I think, again, you know, due diligence is the key. And this is where actually being on the ground also makes a difference. So for example, just to give you a very simple tip that anyone could use, this is something we also do as part of our, you know, the ad hoc company verification service that we do, is we not only verify that the company is legit and whether they're a supplier, but we also verify the individual that our client is talking to see if they're an employee there or not. So we would just give them a cold call and ask for that employee and check with other employees whether they're actually employed there. And it's something very simple, takes us 5 minutes, but allows us to see if they're actually employed by that company or not.
Call the factory. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. You would just call the factory. I suppose it's like you would do if you're getting a landlord's reference, if you're renting out a property to somebody, you might just phone their previous landlord to get a reference and then phone their employer and just double check, A, they do actually work at Pizza Hut or whatever it is, and B, that, you know, they're still employed there. So
And you know, I could get into other hacks where literally I've been to a factory with someone that this is when I was in China in the early days, and they went into the factory and then they literally sat at the boss's chair trying to convince us that, like, this guy was the boss. And eventually when we were trying to go out, and I was like, where is the toilet? And they were kind of confused and looking around. The other thing we noted was when this guy, this is a different case. I went to a factory with this guy and he walked in and everything. Again, he claimed to be a manager, but no other worker recognized him while we were with him. So there's a lot of these little cues you can pick up on. And you know, you just have to understand China for that. But yeah, these things are very common in China. Factories have great relationships with traders and trading companies, and they would be more than happy for them to be the boss for a day if that helps them get more business.
Yeah. So my other question then is about all this. People spend an awful lot of time stressing about this. Does it even matter? Does it affect price and does it affect quality?
I personally think it does, but I think if you're a smaller buyer, it might not make that much of a difference. So for example, if you have got no one on the ground and you're employing a sourcing company, it might actually make sense for you to work with a trading company because they do bring in some value, like being able to communicate in English. It's going to be very hard for someone with no resources on the ground to be able to manage a Chinese factory that's not very international. So in that case, that working with a trading company would be your best option. For us, we prefer to work with factories because in terms of QCs, it gives us a lot more control. You know, when we have issues, we can give solutions to the factory and we can get them to try those out. Whereas with a trading company, you have another layer of communication that makes problem solving more challenging. And it also, obviously, if this person is in the middle, they would mark up the product. So that would definitely have an impact on pricing. If you have the scale and the resources, and going direct to factory gives you more value. But there are use cases where working with a factory might make, or with a trading company might make more sense.
Yeah, so if it's quite small anyway, and you don't have the money to pay for a sort of somebody to do things properly for you on the ground, I guess. And I can understand that, yeah, it would make a difference to quality control. If there's a problem, then direct communication is always best, really. So let's just talk a little bit more about that then. So if you're sourcing yourself, assuming that you're not outsourcing somebody, what's the best way of doing it? Do you need to visit China is one question that comes up.
I think there's different views on this, and I've had this discussion a few times, and a lot of the traditional importers, they're really big on visiting China for everything they do. My take on this is it all comes down to the ROI. If you're placing a $5,000 order, I wouldn't spend another $5,000 on traveling to China, plane tickets and hotels and stuff, because it just messes up the ROI. But there are other ways of doing, you know, that's the beautiful thing about the age we live in. You can do really high quality due diligence and QC and stuff sitting at home. So I think as the volume start increasing, it starts making sense. But again, there has to be a business case for it for me personally. for it to be feasible to travel.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. And I think it always surprises me when you get these courses where people will go on sourcing visits with you know, for a large amount of money. That's pay $5,000 or $10,000 just to kind of get taken around China on a little tour, which seems to me, okay, well, you could do that whilst actually making some useful business. But sure. A lot of the time, that's for half the people on these trips, having spoken to people who run them or other people who've been on them, are actually raw beginners with no products in the market. And I just find that a very strange use of money and time. I mean, it's sort of like tourism, only not really to attractive places. So yeah, I think the business case thing has to come first, not ROI, as you say. But as you say, you could do a lot of things online. So what the things can you do to be still very professional? We've talked an awful lot about the importance of doing things properly, and I couldn't agree more from my personal experience and those of people who've done things in an amateurish way and people who do things well. And the contrast is huge. But the worst case scenario, just to give you an example, is that somebody who's very new and had just sourced, I think, some electronics from China, had just ordered $20,000 worth of for a second order, and then had all her listings but one suspended by Amazon because there was some massive defect rate. So this is your typical horror story where we don't want to be. So we've got to do it well. How do we do it well online then? What are the best things that we need to be doing? And you mentioned quite a few, but let's just sort of summarize that.
Sure, yeah. So I would kind of go back to what we discussed previously in terms of putting down a QC process. So to summarize it, you know, start with doing a due diligence on the supplier. So again, it's something that can be done. Like, for example, the ad hoc services we have, it's from $100 to $300. You could literally know everything about a supplier. We literally, you know, have this 25-page report which covers everything about the supplier's IP, financials, and stuff. Then I would, again, put a contract in place with the supplier, have a solid QC checklist, as a minimum, a carry-out and pre-shipment inspection, and even get random samples drawn from that inspection and send back to you as, I mean, you can send back a couple of samples, or you can even send back a carton and look at that. And once you're satisfied that the final production meets your standards, only then ship it out. So it adds another week or so to the process. But, you know, like I said before, you have to spot issues while the goods are still in China and while you haven't paid the balance to the supplier. There's a lot that can be done at that stage. Once the goods are on the sea, then the equation changes completely.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I like this. There's very simple stuff that anyone, even a beginner, could do, but certainly anyone who's been in business for a while should be doing that. So the contract, do you work with Chinese lawyers? Because obviously having a contract in Chinese is quite not in most people's abilities for legal and linguistic reasons.
Yeah, so we have, that's actually the contract's one of our biggest levers that we use, because we have a, you know, more than 12-page contract now, and we have kind of refined that over a period of time depending on our experiences. Everything that has gone wrong eventually translates into an upgrade of the process and the contract. So having done that over the years, and it's been, you know, the contract's never really been a legal tool for us till date. It's always been a negotiation tool. And it's really helped us. I mean, we have a pretty good track record of being able to recover money from Chinese factories when things have gone wrong on the back of the contract. So, yeah, that's. I mean, but, you know, if you were doing this yourself and you didn't have the budget for a sourcing company and stuff, you could still come up with something basic. At least have an English contract. That's better than not having a contract at all, you know, because at least when things go wrong, you could go back to the supplier and say, hey, this is what it says on the contract. And if you can communicate with me in English, then I'm sure you can read what's on the contract.
Yeah, I mean, it may not have legal power, but at least it's got some kind of negotiation or appealing to their good sense or their sense of honor, possibly. I've heard that the Chinese will respect written contracts a lot more than just verbal agreements. So that and it kind of makes sense for any culture, but I've heard that they have particular respect for the written contract. Is that true, or does it really depend on how it's framed and how much legal teeth it has?
That's a really interesting question, because I have two differing opinion on that. I mean, the first thing is, yes, we have found that when things are in writing, the negotiation becomes a lot easier. And once we show them, the suppliers are willing to accept, you know, where they're wrong and fix things. So that's definitely true. On the other hand, you know, we've had suppliers where we send them a 12-page contract and 5 minutes later, they sent it back to us stamped and everything. So we know a lot of them are not even reading it. And they only read it when things go wrong and when something goes wrong. So I know this to be true for a lot of the factories.
Yeah.
But yes, chill. I mean, you know, going back to the first point, it's been a great negotiating tool because I have seen suppliers respect the written word when there's disagreement over what was agreed.
Yeah, and but presumably those are contracts written in Chinese by Chinese lawyers. Is that right? The contracts you're referring to.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that doesn't make the difference. So I guess that's presumably going to be pretty difficult for people to achieve if they're not actually in China.
I mean, you can always hire lawyers online, but I think the language makes a little bit of a difference, but only if you were planning to actually take the legal route. You know, if your goal is just to get the supplier on the same page, I think a simple contract that lays out the specifications and the agreement is still a good negotiating tool. It's still better than nothing, you know.
Yeah, so you're talking about a simple contract in Chinese.
In English. I'm talking about the minimum possible thing that you can do is having an English contract.
Cool. All right. So look, we talked a lot about the way of doing things yourself. Obviously, you deal with doing things on behalf of your clients. So we've been sort of stepping politely around that. But obviously, that is something that people might want to explore. So just briefly, let's talk in general first. How should people go around finding a business to outsource their sourcing to? So in other words, who's going to handle or manage the process? It's a big question, but let's just deal with the simple basics of it in this episode. And we'll get into this in detail in future episodes.
Sure. So, sourcing is a very fragmented industry. You got sourcing companies in all shapes and sizes. You got the freelance sourcing agents that are individuals who probably worked in sourcing companies before and then went freelance. You got companies with 3 to 5 people. You got companies like us that is more of a whole supply chain management thing. So sourcing actually takes us about 15% of our time and effort. 85% of it is other stuff like production management, contracts, negotiating exclusivity rights, payment terms, stuff like that. So it's more of a full supply chain management. We are even in the process of considering to kind of change our business name, you know, as we discussed when I was in London, because sometimes people get misled by our name. But there are different options out there, and it all boils down to finding that right fit for your needs. For example, recently a client reached out to us and they said they wanted someone. They were going to be in China for 2 weeks and they wanted someone who would be with them for 2 weeks and travel with them to the factories and stuff. And they were just starting out. So in that case, a freelancer would actually make more sense. Whereas, you know, if you're dealing with slightly bigger shipments and you compliance is important for you, payment terms are important for you, and you're looking to launch a lot of products in a short period of time and scale the business, then a company like ours would be able to add more value. So it's all about identifying your needs and finding a partner that can fulfill those needs at a cost that works for you.
That makes a lot of sense. So I guess, yeah, it's no point in having a sledgehammer to crack a nut, as we say in the UK. So it's a question of not using a massive, you know, your company, which is now pretty sophisticated abilities for something where you just need somebody to help you out. But yeah, if you're looking to scale the business and I guess we're also from our conversation today, proof yourself, your business and against future possibilities of problems like QC issues down the line, compliance issues, not having the ability, should there be a problem in future, even if there isn't one now, to go back to supplier with a robust contract, all that kind of stuff. It sounds like, you know, there is an increasingly strong business case, as you put it, to be using a company like IMEX Sourcing. So that makes sense. And we'll have you back on the podcast at some point to discuss in detail how to work with an outsourcing company, because it's obviously a huge area. But for anyone who's interested in working with you guys or finding out a bit more, for example, about the ad hoc, what do you call it, the ad hoc supply intelligence or due diligence service, then how do people contact you?
Sure. So our website is IMEX. It's IMEX. Sourcing services with an S at the end .com. So that's one way of reaching out to us. If you want to reach out to me personally, I'm quite accessible on Facebook. If you just search for Ash Monga, or my email is ash@imexhostingservices.com as well.
Okay, cool. So it's just reach out and have a chat. So yeah, lots of things that we've learned today. I think that's been a very, so that sounds a bit like, I can't help sounding like a teacher sometimes. It comes out and it's in my blood. My mum was a teacher and so was her mother. But yeah, certainly a lot of things that I've learned, put it that way. And you know, I've obviously been having conversations about these for you know, for whatever years now. So there is a lot that goes into sourcing. And I think if nothing else, this has been eye-opening, hopefully even for quite advanced sellers, that to think about the issues that you can hit, but also some possible solutions. So really great to have you on. We'll definitely get you back, Ash, because it's an area that everyone needs to understand in detail and is obviously the most complex area, I think, of anything that we do as marketers, especially if you're marketing-focused. So thank you very, very much for coming on. Have you got any last, any sort of summary tip that you would like to leave us with? I know it's a hell of a thing to ask in areas complex as sourcing. One or two things that people should think about that they don't tend to.
Yeah, I would say, you know, again, I reemphasize what we discussed earlier. This is something so basic, but probably the biggest cause of all QC issues, which is really know your product before you start the sourcing phase. You know, the standard the standard sourcing process for most sellers is go on Alibaba, get 20 quotes, look cheapest three, and then talk about specs. You know, you have to turn that process around and define your specs in a lot of detail, then start the sourcing process, find the top three suppliers that can meet that spec, and then talk pricing. And this makes all the difference in terms of avoiding QC issues further down the road. Because with the first process, you've eliminated good suppliers very early in the process, and then you're trying to find the best among the worst. So yeah, that would be the most important thing, I'd say.
Trying to find the best amongst the worst. I like nice thinking. So yeah, in other words, think about the thing that you want as the end result of the process before you start the process, I guess, to put in simple terms, right?
Exactly, absolutely.
Makes 100% sense to me. But still, from the horse's mouth, I mean, a man who's been in China and running a sourcing business for 9 years, this is definitely worth knowing. So, Ash, thank you so much for coming on. We'll definitely get back on. But for now, many, many thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot for having me, Michael. Really appreciate that. And good luck with everything.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.